No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to send in a question via Skype to BBS Radio or call us at 888-628-6008 if you have a question, and we'd love to have you on the show. I'm sorry, 627-6008. This is a problem when you get old, you mix things up. But tonight we have a very special guest. I'm pleased to have Tom McMillan on the show. Tom is currently the president and chief executive officer of Lead One Association. He's an amazing athlete. I'm sure that we all remember when he played for 11 seasons in the NBA. As a high school student, he was one of the most highly recruited athletes of his era, only the second high school student ever to appear on the cover of Sports Illustrated. He was also appointed by President Richard Nixon to serve as the youngest presidential appointee ever on the President's Council on Physical Fitness. Like I say, played 11 seasons in the NBA, a Rhodes Scholar, congressman from the 4th District of Maryland for 3 terms. This man has done it all. And as a former Maryland Terrapin, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Tom, welcome.
Mike, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And, you know, it's you've done so many things. You have such a storied career. The first thing I want to ask you is what are you doing right now? Tell us a little bit about Lead One and how important that is and why you're dedicating your time to that. Why you dedicated your time to that?
So Lead One is an association that's been around since 1986 that represents all the largest college athletic programs. It's not part of the NCAA. It's a separate entity. And, our schools, which include, schools like Texas, Alabama, Maryland, Navy, UCLA, USC, all the biggest schools in America with college sports programs, generate about $8 billion in revenue. I mean, it's a really big business. It's on a par with the NBA. And so there's lots of issues that come up. And we have worked on those issues over the years. I've done this for about 8+ years. I'm actually winding down from it on September 30th. And I'm going to be doing some other things, including working with Jim Moran on his firm. You know, Jim, who represented...
Yeah.
Doing some government relations with him, and serving on a lot of boards. I'm on the University of Maryland board. I'm on corporate boards. So I have several companies. So I'm staying busy.
Yeah, I'm sure you are, and you've done so many things in your life and politics and beyond politics and sports. And, you know, I have great admiration for any athlete because I was the worst kid on my little league team. And, you know, when I was a little boy, right, that's what little boys did. I played every sport, and I had a brother who was a pretty decent athlete. And he used to say things to me like, if mom ever sells our big station wagon, they'll cut you from the team. The only reason you're on the team is because you can fit not all 9 baseball players in the car at one time. But anyway, beyond being a great athlete, which we'll talk about in a minute, you served 3 consecutive terms from Maryland's 4th District. What do you think has been the biggest change that you see between the 100th Congress and the 118th Congress?
Well, it's interesting because I came into Congress with Nancy Pelosi. She was part of my class. And so what I would say is that when I was in the Congress, there were always extreme elements. There were a couple members on the left and a couple members on the right who were considered very extreme by the sort of the body politic of Congress. Today, that number's bigger. It's probably 20, 25 on each, or even more on each spectrum. And that has led to greater polarization, less, less willingness to work together. I can say that that's one change that I've seen, that the extremes are more pronounced in Congress, and a lot of that is due to redistricting. I was a victim of redistricting.
Right.
They took a moderate district like mine, which represented, Anne Arundel and Southern Prince George's about 23% minority, and they turned it into two districts. It turned into more districts, but one was a minority district, and the other was the votes were spread around other districts. But across the country, that's happened, where they have packed votes into minority districts, and then you have relatively conservative districts on the other side. So that creates polarization, and that's what we see in Congress. So one of the things that I would add to that is that not only were there more extremists today than before, the other thing was, I've asked members today, do they know the Republicans on the other side? Or do they know even all their members of Congress? And they don't. I'm quite surprised by that. When I was in Congress, I knew all 435 members of Congress. Not well, but I could walk up to them and say hello. That's not the case today.
Well, do you think that, first of all, Nancy Pelosi, I've got to tell you very quickly, I stood in Chuck Benat's office. Chuck was the head of the DNC in those days, and I was a staff person. And he hung up the phone and he said to me and the three other people that were there for a meeting, "We've got this woman named Nancy coming from California, and she's going to be a vice chair, and she's going to be very special." And that's like one of the most serious understatements I've ever heard in politics. So I'm a big fan of Pelosi's, and it seems to me that Congress, those people that came in, just don't exist anymore. And do you think some of it, I used to live on Capitol Hill right behind the Capitol, and I used to just walk in and walk out, and there's tons of security now. It's a very, very, it's almost like an encampment. Do you think that's added to that whole sense of disassociation between members, that it's become such almost like a protected camp up there?
Well, if we go back a little further than that, Jerry Ford always said that the ruination of Congress was the airplane, jet airways, because what happened was back in the 60s and 70s and even in the 80s, members would drive back to their districts. So Dan Rastikowski would drive back with, a Republican, and Tip O'Neill would drive back with another Republican, and you had families that came to Washington who brought their kids here. They went to school, so members had kids in school together, and they were in kind of a normal situation. And today, members fly in here, they fly right out on Tuesday. They come in on Tuesday, they fly right out on Thursday, generally, and there are less relationships built. And I think that's that's been a hindrance. And so one of the things that I would say is that Silvio Conte was a Republican who drove to Massachusetts with Tip O'Neill, and they played cards together, and they had a real relationship. And I think that part of Congress is missing today. One of the things that I think should be done, and a lot of people get criticized for taking overseas trips, but I think they're very important. I think it's important for members to go to these hotspots in the world and see what's going on. But I would mandate that freshmen, particularly freshmen, have to go on a CODEL, which is what they're called when they travel, with other freshmen, including Republicans and Democrats. I think by traveling together, and that was one of the unifying things that I did when I was in Congress. If I went on a trip, I got to know Republicans real well. The other way I got to know Republicans real well, believe it or not, was in the House gym. We would go down and play basketball together, and they don't do that much anymore. And so I think a lot is lost by the fact that they don't have that institutional togetherness that was previously the case.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say that, because I went to Nebraska recently to testify before the United States Senate for the Nebraska State Senate on a statehood resolution. And I spent a couple days in Lincoln, and I got to talk to people. And all I could think to myself is, we need to get politicians out of Washington and back to places like Lincoln, Nebraska, because people out there think totally different than we do here in Washington. And I don't think we get it sometimes. I think that's our Achilles heel as politicians. And I think you're right. I think that the fact that we don't associate with each other anymore. You know, there are storied relationships, which you know of, like Bob Dole and Ted Kennedy, who were great friends on opposite ends of the aisle. And that's a big problem. I agree. Let me ask you, let me move on to sports, since you were such a sports icon. I met you in 1980. I don't know if you remember this. Probably not. It's the Democratic Convention, because you.
No, I actually do remember. I do remember. Yeah.
And you walked into a reception, and a lot of people turned around. You get a lot of attention, Tom, when you're as tall. When you're a tall, handsome guy, people turn around and look at you. And I could see that people were struggling to try to figure out who you were. And I knew immediately, because I'd gone to the University of Maryland. So I rushed over and introduced myself. I probably gushed. I'm surprised you didn't call security on me. But, let's talk about sports a little bit. How about transgenders in sports? What do you think about that? I have a real problem with a guy that, you know, is a man who's a swimmer that goes through an operation, ends up competing with women. Do you think is that okay to have transgenders in sports? What do you think?
Well, my wife's a doctor, and we've talked about this issue. And, you know, once someone hits puberty, it's really hard to change. And, you know, I think that should be the definition. What sexual identity you have at puberty should define going forward, define you going forward. Now, you can change your gender, but when it comes to competitive sports, that becomes a really very, very challenging issue. I'm of the view that if someone is a male at puberty, they should have to compete as a male in sports events subsequently. Now, listen, I'm very open and progressive on these issues, and I would say that, look, they need to figure out another solution besides having post-puberty transgender athletes compete against women athletes.
Yeah,
I just don't think that is fair My wife was a swimmer. She was very, very good swimmer. If she had not been hit by a car when she was a young girl, she probably would have been an Olympian. And, you know, a lot of these kids who spend their whole life competing, these women,
right,
are just being, taken really secondary in a secondary position by these transgender athletes. And I think we need to think about it. I'm not diminishing or denying people's rights to do all this, but it does need some consideration. And especially when they're post-puberty and changing their sex, that's what becomes very problematic.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, you know, Caitlin Clark is a great basketball player, but she couldn't compete in the NBA. You were in the NBA, right? She couldn't, you couldn't put her into a male professional basketball team, most likely, because she wouldn't have the strength or the size or the, yeah, I think it's very unfair. I really do, and I agree with you 100%. But yeah.
The Republicans use as this wedge issue, in other words, Democrats or for, you know, totally for transgender athletes. And look, I am perfectly okay with transgender athletes competing.
Yeah, of course.
It's just that I'm not sure that once they go post-puberty that they should be competing against women who are, and I think those are the complications here. And it becomes one of these wedge issues that Democrats are struggling with.
Yeah, it really is. And I think a lot of people have a problem with it. And of course, they speak of it in different terms, not so much the competitive terms as, you know, having men in your daughter's high school locker room, you know, which I think all fathers would be against. But yeah, they use it as a real wedge issue, and it's terrible. But how about women in sports, right? They're really coming of age, aren't they? I know you do a lot with collegiate athletes, and we've just seen this meteoric rise, right, to people like Caitlin Clark and our women's soccer team and World Cup soccer team, and there's been a real rise. I remember at Maryland, they always complained, the women that were in sports always complained about how men got everything, you know, how the men's basketball team got everything they needed, but the women's basketball team didn't necessarily. And I know that you deal with this issue all the time. I read in one of your op-eds, for example, that the average salary of a college coach is $2.7 million. Really? That didn't exist when the Lefty Driesell didn't get $2.7 million, did he?
No. And let me focus on Title IX. I'll come back.
Okay. Yeah, please.
You know, I think Title IX has been one of the most amazing laws that have transformed sports in America. I mean, really, it's truly amazing what women are doing now because they've been given opportunity. And it's amazing. And you just have to look at what Caitlin's doing to recognize how important that is. I mean, in a lot of respects, I enjoy watching her more than I enjoy watching men's sports in some reason. And I think a lot of people feel that way. So Title IX is very important because it has mandated investments in women's sports. And there's always been a lot of pushback. There continues to be pushback. And it's remarkable that 1970 law, 70-some law,
yeah,
has dramatically changed college sports. Now, when you get to the commercialization of college sports and coaches making all these kinds of crazy salaries, you know, I was in Congress, and literally when I was there in the 90s, I said, you know, we're soon to have a $1 million football coach And we had one in 1995, Bobby Beaton. And what happened was, I said at the time that we're going to have million-dollar players. Well, it took a long time for that to happen, but we have million-dollar players today. And what's happened in college sports is this tremendous professionalization, commercialization of college sports. And I'm not sure in the long run that's in the best interest of college sports, but that's where we are. And part of it is because, you know, you can fire a coach and pay them $75 million, and, you know, athletes are being told what they're going to get. And so it's just a natural extension that, you know, they were going to hire up lawyers and fight all this. And so what's happened is these antitrust lawyers have really taken over college sports. And I think there's more to come here. I'm not sure that the end all is going to be this rampant professionalism of college sports. I mean, we may have to turn the clock back and look at other models. But one of the problems with this commercialization is that it means that a lot of ancillary sports that don't make money, that aren't, you know, revenue generators, are going to be cut. And that's the crux of our Olympic team. I mean, in Paris, 70% of our team was from colleges. And a lot of those sports are going to be cut as a result of this professionalism.
Well, as so many people in America, my wife was a high school jock, you know, so many people have gotten so much out of sports, right? That don't ever reach the kind of levels that players like you reach, you know. But I know my brother played college football, played for a community college, Montgomery Community College, and they all got so much out of sports. He had a great career, ended up as a president of a college, and I think he would tell you that sports played a big role in his development as a person. It would really be horrible, right? If we focus just on basketball and football and baseball and not lacrosse or whatever the other sports are that so many other athletes are involved in, so many other athletes that don't make it to levels like the Olympics. But go ahead.
You're not going to know where the next Caitlin Clark's going to come from. She is a phenomenon, but if she didn't have this opportunity, she would never emerge. I mean, by the way, it's been estimated that 90% of female C-suite executives played college sports. I mean, that's an extraordinary statistic that these women are going right from the athletic field to corporate America, and that's true of men too. And so it's a great building block. It should be expanded. We don't want to limit it. We want to create more opportunities, not less.
Well, and talk about expanding it. You were on the President's Council on Physical Fitness, appointed by Richard Nixon and later appointed by Bill Clinton. I remember in high school that we used to, the President's Council on Physical Fitness used to set standards, I believe, and we were involved in physical, you know, we were all involved in physical fitness when we were in high school, and that seems to be changing. What do we do to get more sports into our lives? You know, because I'm a diabetic. I just lost 70 pounds. It's a rampant disease in America. We have too much. We're too sedentary, right? We need more activity in our lives. So what can we do, do you think, to inject more sports into schools and into the upbringing of our children?
Well, in a lot of respects, you have to think about countries as their sports as a pyramid. And smart nations, you know, have an upright pyramid. So they put a lot of the resources at the bottom of the pyramid, and the elite sports get less resources. But in America, we invert that. We give all the money to elite sports, And we don't do enough. There's not enough, you know, basketball courts in Washington. There's not enough places for kids to go out and safely recreate. And as a nation, that's really fundamental. And, you know, America's the only nation, one of the few nations in the world, doesn't have a sports minister. You know, when I chaired the President's Council, that was the equivalent of it. But we didn't have budgets. We didn't have the kind of resources that China is putting into their youth. And this is a big problem in America, because you pointed out that, you know, a third of Americans are overweight, 40% or have obesity issues. This is a terrible problem, and it's leading to early diabetes and all the things that you referred to. I mean, we need to wake up as a nation. This is not about elite sports. But, you know, I always tell a story that when I headed up the President's Council, co-headed it up, I went to the Lillehammer Olympics with Mrs. Clinton, and I was always amazed how the Lillehammer, the Norwegians, celebrated that they were given the Olympics by a million Norwegians going out cross-country skiing. I said, wow, that's a great way to celebrate the Olympics. And then I went 4 years later, 2 years later, to Atlanta, to the Atlanta Olympics. And you know how we celebrated the Atlanta Olympics, the fact that we were awarded the games in Atlanta? We had torch runners run the streets with a million spectators. And if that was so not so symbolic, Norway celebrated by a million people going out cross-country skiing. We celebrated by watching torch runners run the streets. And the fact is that America has really fundamental problems here, and we do not put this as a high enough priority. And I think we're going to begin to do this. Let me tell you why, what's most important here. And I'm glad you raised this issue, because I talked to Wes Moore, Governor Moore, about this. Do you know that in the 50s, when Eisenhower created the President's Council, he was concerned that America wasn't going to be able to fit enough to man an army. After World War II, of course, America got maybe a little less concerned about this, because they were on to other things. And he became concerned about it because the Germans and other nations were outpacing us on this, and so he created the President's Council. Today, we need a similar effort by a president to say, this is extremely important in America. We need a national campaign, because here's the fact, 70% of our kids, of our young people, aren't even eligible to serve in the military. So we don't even have the ability to man an army anymore in America. So this has taken on, like Eisenhower, national security issues, national security concerns. And, you know, we need to focus on this, because it's important for the security of America.
Well, and, you know, just as an economics thing as well, right, that if we invest in sports and we keep people from becoming diabetic and overweight and, you know, all these things, haven't we saved billions of dollars in the long run on what health costs is? And isn't, you know, the cost of health one of our major economic drivers these days? Isn't it worth the investment?
Of course, you're absolutely right there. But you know what moves nations? What moves nations when they have security issues? That is, you know, that's just the way it works. I mean, you can go to Congress and say, look, you know, this is causing diabetes and the healthcare costs to go up. But when you go to Congress and you say, look, America is not able to man an army to defend itself, that takes on a whole different level.
Yeah. And
my experience over the years, national security issues trump everything else.
Yeah, absolutely do. And let me ask you, if you don't mind, to recall, you were part of the 1972 Olympic basketball team. It's a very controversial basketball team because of what happened with in the final game against the Russians. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience? Because I know you told me about it one time that you were chosen to be the spokesman for the team given the controversy, and then that horrible, horrible thing happened in Montreal. Can you talk about that a minute?
Yeah, I mean, the game was in Munich, Germany.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. Our basketball game was 5 days after the village was raided by terrorists and the Israeli athletes were killed. So it was a very, very, emotional to play a game under all those pressures. And we were playing the Soviet Union for the World Championship, and the United States team had never lost since the basketball was introduced into the 1936 game. And we had a very young team. The Soviets had a very old team, very mature. They were professionals. And we had to come from behind to beat them. We scored a free throw. Doug Collins scored free throws at the very end to put us up by 1 point. And there were only like 3 seconds to go. And we thought the game was over, except the officials kept replaying the last play. And one time they could not score. Two times they could not score. And on the third time, they were able to finally score. And we were shocked by the outcome. And we refused to accept the silver medal. So to this day, we do not have a silver medal because we protested the outcome of that game.
Well, and wasn't it a Soviet referee? Am I wrong about that? That it was a Soviet referee that kept on interfering at the end of the game? Wasn't that one of the issues?
Well, I mean, there were officials of mixed origin, and some of them were from the East Bloc. But what happened was it went to an appeals committee, and the appeals committee was 3 countries from the Eastern Bloc, 2 from the Western Bloc, and all 3 from the Eastern Bloc voted. So it was a very political outcome. I often said that Brezhnev and Nixon could have just arm wrestled. We did not need to play that because that game was sort of, the conclusion was preordained.
There were no professional athletes on your team at the time. Were you all collegiate athletes, were you not?
We were all collegiate athletes. They did not go to full professionalization of the American team until 1992 with the Dream Team, which I was delighted by because we lost in 1988 again. And, you know, America should not play with its hands tied.
Right.
And so the idea of putting our best athletes forward made a lot of sense. It's really changed the Olympics, and it should have been done a long time ago. But we were one of the byproducts of that evolution.
Well, and you know what? I think, correct me if I'm wrong again, but it seems to me that it's gotten more intense and more intense over the years. Recently, in the recent Olympic Games, right, it seemed that there were a lot of close games with the American team, even though the American team won the gold medal. It seemed to be a much more challenging field than in the past. Do you think that's true, or it's just my imagination?
No, what's interesting about our game, 1972, the United States was very successful exporting basketball. We sent our best coaches around the world, and we helped all of them develop programs. And when we ended up having that game against the Russians in 72, the Soviets, people around the world said, wait a minute, now we can really compete with the Americans. So
right.
The outcomes of those games were byproducts of America's great export of coaching. And now all these players around the world, look, the NBA has been the greatest beneficiary. 25% of the NBA is made up of international players. That would not have happened if it were not for America's export of its coaching talent. And we sent people all over the world, and look what's happened. It's been great. You know, years ago, I was invited to go to China on the first basketball team to ever go to China. I didn't go when I was in college. I was working in the U.S. Senate, but basketball didn't even exist in China. Years later, I went back to China, and there's thousands of basketball courts. China is so big with basketball. It's incredible. And all that was developed because of American influence.
Yeah. And, you know, we've seen, Yao Ming, right? We've seen great basketball players come from all over the world to play in the NBA as well. And what do you think? I think this is a great business move. As a businessman and a professional athlete, what do you think about us playing football games in places like Brazil and London and places like that? I think that's a really smart move on the part of the NFL. What do you think?
Well, of course. I went over to the first game ever by the NFL with Jack Kemp. It was 1992 in Berlin, and it was right at the time of the Berlin Wall collapsing, and it was a monumental game. It was an exhibition game, a preseason game, but it was the beginning of the internationalization of NFL football. It was a spectacular experience. Now, the NBA has been a little bit ahead of the game. I mean, they are really planted big in lots of countries in Africa. And I can tell you that basketball is a huge sport and huge opportunity. There's huge opportunity in Africa. So I think the NBA is ahead of the NFL, but the NFL is very smart to, you know, go after these international markets. Because when you say football in Europe or in Africa, it means a wholly different game than football. It means soccer. And so the NFL has a tougher challenge, but it's still a huge opportunity, which I agree with you on.
Well, and you know what? It's been great, the interchange of sports, right? Because we didn't really play soccer when I was a kid. There were three sports for boys, and they were baseball, football, and basketball. And my son was a high school soccer player, pretty good soccer player. And soccer's a great sport. It's a great sport, right? Because you can start kids at 2 years old. You know, I remember my kids playing soccer at such an early age that the coaches walked behind them to show them, you know, which way to kick the ball. They were like 4 and 5 and 6 years old when they started playing. A lot of sports is hard to play at that age because you don't have the physicality to do it. But so that's been a great exchange for us too, right? We've embraced soccer with kids and we get them out there and it really is a great sport. And my son and I still argue about it when he calls it football. I go, that's not football. Okay, come on. That's not. But
when I grew up in small town Pennsylvania, we did not have football. We had soccer. It's hard to believe.
Is that right? And yeah.
I used to go out and play soccer during recess. I mean, there were some touch football, but soccer was a sport that we learned, but also touch football as well. We never played tackle football.
Well, you know, this is a strange thing that happened in my life as a teenager. I worked in Cleveland, Ohio for a guy that had been a soccer player from Bermuda. He played on the national team. And he took me to an exhibition game to see a guy named Pele who had come from Brazil. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm like, oh, I don't want to go. And he's like, you got to see this guy. You got to see this guy. And so like in 1968, I saw Pele play in an exhibition game against the Cleveland Stokers. And yeah, it's an experience I'll always remember. But yeah, I grew up around Washington, and in Montgomery County, we just didn't, you know, soccer was that strange sport that they had in gym sometimes, but we really didn't play. But it's been great. You know, all my kids played it. All three of my kids, my two girls and my son, all played, and they all got something out of it. So I think it's been a great exchange internationally. Now, I don't know that we want rugby, because that seems to be like a crazy sport, like football without equipment. But you know, I think that we benefit from it as much as in accepting the athletics of other countries as well. So let me ask you, what do we need to do for college athletes? Now that I really don't understand how it's going to work that these guys get paid, but I heard that Tagovailoa, who was I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, our quarterback from Maryland last year, was offered $1 million. Is that college athletes, can they get paid that much?
Well, I don't think if you're a big time quarterback, you in a major program, I think that is competitive payment, and it's these things are, it's such a turbulent space, because a lot of this is being paid by third party boosters and collectives, and you know, when I grew up, all that was prohibited. Now it's embraced, and so it's become very problematic for people that are trying to keep college sports within a box that sort of fits into the higher education model. I mean, what happened was, when coaches and administrators started making millions of dollars, inevitable that players were going to make millions. I mean, the question that you always have to ask is that what the end result of that will be. Other sports are going to be cut, so you're going to be decreasing opportunities in college sports, not enhancing them. For a lot of kids that may not play sports that are big revenue sports, I mean, they could play, you know, women's lacrosse or a whole host of women's softball, and these sports are going to be under lots of competitive pressure as a result of this. So it's a model that I'm not sure what the longevity of this is going to be. I think that there's very probably going to be a major sports betting scandal on our college campuses, and that's going to wake up a lot of presidents and boards and trustees about, you know, how far do they want to go here. We're the only nation in the world that has major sports betting on college sports events. And there's a lot of ramifications to that, and a lot of consequences that we may not see today, but we will probably see it tomorrow.
Well, and yeah, don't you think it's corrupting? I mean, I lament the whole money in sports things. I remember running into the president of the University of Maryland at a game one time. We were in the president's box, and I said to him how disappointed I was that we went into the Big Ten. I said, "What am I supposed to do with my hatred for Duke? You know, I spent my college career rooting for Maryland basketball and hating North Carolina and Duke and Wake Forest and all the other schools in the ACC. Now I've got to become a fan of the Big Ten." And that seemed to be, to me, to be all about money. Wasn't that all about money that they decided to do that, to switch?
What happened was, in 1984, there was a Supreme Court decision that overturned the NCAA's television monopoly on college sports, and it broke it up. And so who stepped into that were the conferences. And the conferences were the ones who are now negotiating these TV contracts that became very Darwinian and competitive. So, you know, every conference was dog-eat-dog, and, you know, the Big Ten was playing that game, and they said, look, we need more eyeballs. Rutgers in Maryland brings us more eyeballs. We can get a lot more money if we bring them in. And so you're right. It became a lot about money. I was on the Board of Regents at the time. I voted against it as the only region to vote against because of the way it was done, not necessarily the fact that it was done. I mean, there were lots of things I could go into about why I thought they should have slowed it down a bit. But this is a rampant occurrence in college sports today, schools jumping conferences. I think in the long run that we would be better served now going back to a more NFL model and trying to curtail some of these excesses, which would mean that you'd have to monopolize television in one entity, like whether it's the conferences or the NCAA or whatever. But I'm not sure that that's going to happen, and we're going to continue to see these musical chairs in college sports where teams are just going to jump conferences every year. That's happening right now, as you see the Pac-12, now the Pac-2, try to add a whole bunch of schools. And the only way that's going to get slowed down is if the lawsuits that are going on in the ACC, if somehow the grant of rights, which is when a school says to a conference, I'll give you my television rights, you go negotiate a global package for me. Unless those contracts are voided and the conferences are kind of go back to where they were, which is sort of scheduling offices, you're going to see more and more of this revolving door of schools jumping from conference to conference because of money. And that's just the world we live in right now.
Well, and doesn't that take something off this out of college sports, in terms of fan participation? I go to a invitational. I've been the last 2 years, I've been to the Bronx to see Maryland basketball play in this invitational. They've done great. They beat North Carolina a couple of years ago, and they went all the way to the national championship. And they last time I saw them, they beat Tennessee. And I'm going up to see them in New York in November play Villanova. And, that's the beauty of college sports, right? We're all enthused because we went to that, to the University of Maryland, and there's an excitement that exists. It doesn't exist, I think, in professional sports. And so that jumping from conference to conference to conference, that also affects the fan base too, doesn't it? I mean, it certainly bothers me as a fan, but.
It's an interesting point you make. Unfortunately, the popularity of college sports is going through the roof right now, more popular than ever before. And I think a lot of people are wondering about the growing commercialization, and I think they have concerns, but that's not enough to stop them to go out to the game and support their alma mater or their favorite school. And so it's one of those times where, maybe some point there'll be a breaking point, but we're far from it. And we're going to continue to see this merry-go-round.
Well, let me ask you a personal question. You were only the second high school student ever to appear on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Ever since you've been in high school, the spotlight has been on you, Tom. I assume that there's a lot of pressure in what you've done as a professional athlete, as an Olympic athlete, as a high school and college athlete that had such a distinguished career. Is there any point in your life where you wish that you could escape from the pressure, or you were just, just a regular person, not this person that was in the spotlight all the time? Have you ever felt that? I mean, you've had a fascinating life, but
no, I think it would be so much worse today. When I went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship, by the way, we just celebrated our 50th anniversary of my Rhodes Scholar class. I just came back from Oxford, but I went back over. I went there 1 year, played in Italy, and then I went back 3 summers when I was in the MBA to finish my degree. I couldn't do that today. I don't even think I could have gone and left, United States basketball for 1 year, even though I played in Italy. I could not have done that and been a draft pick in the NBA today. It would have, the pressures would have been too extreme today in America to not go to Oxford and study that. So, no, I was kind of blessed that I could do that, same as Bill Bradley. Today, you couldn't do that. The pressure's too great. I mean, it's really, really hard. The balance between academics and athletics are much more difficult today. And yeah, kids with the money in pro sports, they tilt towards the money. By the way, if I were a college player today and I was of the same ilk when I was in Maryland, I would be focused on it too. I mean, you can make $100 million as a professional basketball player, and you play 10 years. I played 11 years professional sports. You make $100 million. It's crazy money, and it's very distorting because the things that I valued, which was, academics and athletics in balance, it would have been imbalanced because you could not be focused on the enormous wealth that can be created in one decade of your life. And so it puts a lot of pressure on these kids. There's no question about it.
Yeah. And they have, and I certainly realized that. My dad had a guy that worked for him who played for the Washington Redskins. His name was Dave Francis, and he was an All-American from Ohio State. He spent his whole life, a professional athlete. He played for the Redskins, plays in the preseason, gets his back broken in a game, and never plays again. Went back to Ohio, I believe, and became a gym teacher. So, yeah, there's a lot of liability, right, moving from college to professional sports, too. And you understand the pressure to make hay when the sun shines, for lack of a better expression. Well, we're running out of time here, Tom, so let me ask you, Congressman, is there anything you want to add that I didn't ask you?
No, just the election. It's going to be a very close election.
Yeah.
I think we're down to like 7 battleground states, which is, one of the problems with the whole Electoral College is that, a lot of states just get marginalized. I mean, we never have a presidential candidate come into Maryland.
No, ever. Yeah.
It's so preordained. And, I don't know if our Electoral College system is the best solution. And yet, we're down to 7 states. It's going to be a very close election. And I would just say, in general, the American people are dissatisfied in the direction in which the country's going. By the way, that's been the case for the last 40 years. Every poll the last 40 years, Americans have been dissatisfied, except for maybe 3 times. One under Reagan and twice under Clinton. Americans generally are, they have this discontent. And whenever you have discontent in elections, it becomes hard to predict. This election is close. It could go any way. And the American people are very volatile right now. And I think that is the state of the election.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I think that's a perfect way to end things, because that's absolutely the case. It's crazy that we're all our attention is focused on the state of Pennsylvania and Georgia and Arizona and a handful of states. But that's a perfect way to end it. Tom McMillan, I have to tell you, over the years, I've run into you several times. You've always been very kind and generous to me, and I thank you for that, and I thank you for your time. And we dedicate a song at the end of our show. We always play out with a song. We dedicate it to our guests, and I didn't know what athletic song to play for you, so I'm playing one from Shakira. This was the official Olympic song from past Olympics in Africa. So here's Waka Waka for Tom McMillan. Thank you so much. I hope I run into you again, as we both, I'm about to go lecture at Maryland, and I know you're on the Board of Regents, so maybe we'll run into each other. I hope that's the case. Thank you so much. You make me proud to be a Terrapin.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Thanks. See you next week, folks.
Give the people their right to vote.